give us a week or so, maybe even just a few days, because there are there's definitely some things that we can put up there for people who are maybe new to this and want to learn more about their microbiome.
Well, unfortunately, I have to cut you off. We're out of time, but it was great having you both on Health Watch today.
Thank you very much. We enjoyed it. Bye.
Thank you.
We are talking today to co-authors David Montgomery and Ambie Clay about their book, The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. And if you are interested in more, they're coming to Powell's in December. Stay tuned for the rest of the Monday Morning Radio Zine.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Imperialism, Climate Crisis, and Struggle, An Evening with Harsha Walia and Luz Rivera on Sunday, November 8th at 5 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Harsha and Luz will speak about their work and experiences cultivating fierce, loving, and sustainable communities of resistance within a transnational analysis of capitalism, settler colonialism, state building, and racialized empire, and how climate change threatens to or is already compounding the forces of state and corporate violence against which they struggle. Again, that's Imperialism, Climate Crisis, and Struggle, An Evening with Harsha Walia and Luz Rivera on Sunday, November 8th at 5 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. And today, my guest is Mary O'Hara. She's a social affairs journalist and author who's written on mental health issues for more than a decade. She's a writer for The Guardian newspaper, and her new book is called Austerity Bites. It's out in paperback in the U.S. from the Chicago University Press. So welcome to Madness Radio, Mary O'Hara.
Hi, Will. Hi. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, you've been covering disability issues and mental health issues from an economic perspective for The Guardian for quite a long time. And your new book is about the impact of economic crisis and cuts and austerity in the UK. You've made a lot of very, very powerful connections between how economic policies around austerity really impact people's mental health. And I think this work is really important. I really encourage people to check out your page of your writings on The Guardian and also check out the book. So tell us a little bit about, first of all, just what is austerity and why should people interested in mental health understand some of these economic issues?
I write on social policy, and so I wouldn't normally be delving into economics so much, but when austerity was introduced in Britain and in a lot of other countries following the financial crisis, it resonated enormously with people who had experienced mental health difficulties and pushed some other people into mental health difficulties. And a lot of people understandably ask, well, what is it? I mean, what the hell does it mean? Austerity is difficult economic conditions created by government measures to reduce a budget deficit, especially by reducing public expenditure. So that more or less sums it up. When it's introduced, it usually involves cuts to all kinds of public services, including health, including social care. And it also erodes social welfare protections, which affect many, many people. Many of those people either have mental health difficulties already or end up with one as a result of things like losing access to support, cuts to psychiatric services, et cetera, et cetera.
So we're talking about the global economic downturn, I guess, which was in 2008. And then basically public spending cuts are introduced in a number of countries as a way of saying, well, we have to get spending down and respond to the crisis. And that's the austerity practices.
That's right. One of the things that happened in response to the crisis was obviously the banks had to be bailed out. Now, the banks were bailed out with public money. When that happens, public spending ostensibly goes up, deficits go up. So therefore, governments react and say, well, we need to reduce the deficits urgently. We need to cut public spending as a route to do that. And that's what a lot of countries did, not all, but some, including Britain.
So some countries introduced austerity, and I think the U.S. did as well. And so this is a parallel that happens. It's not just the U.K. It's a number of countries. It's part of a broader neoliberal economic policy and social policy. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the initial response to the financial crisis in 2009 by countries, including the U.K. and the U.S., was an economic stimulus. So money was pumped into the economies to keep them ticking over, because there were genuine threats. It was the biggest crisis since the Great Depression. After a year of stimulus, some countries opted to have drastic spending cuts. Now, the US did to some degree, and some states in the US did more than others, but on the whole, there was stimulus in the US where there wasn't in countries like the United Kingdom, Spain, Greece, Italy, Ireland.
Oh, so maybe the austerity wasn't quite as strong a policy in the U.S. as in the European countries.
That's right. And one of the outcomes of that was that the U.S. economy did slightly better than other economies. So, for instance, Britain, which introduced austerity very quickly and very brutally, almost hit what's known as a triple dip recession. And that had enormous consequences for the country, because growth just didn't come back as soon as it would have done otherwise.
So in some ways, the experience of UK and Ireland and in European countries is a cautionary tale.
That's right. But one of the major outcomes of austerity policies is for public health, and that obviously includes mental health. So there's been a lot of research done right from the start in terms of what these human consequences are, one of which is increased rates of suicide in countries that introduce the most severe austerity measures. That has been well documented. There's a wonderful book called The Body Economic, Why Austerity Kills, which looks at the patterns in the different countries and the impact on public health and suicidal behavior.
And so we've seen this in the UK, and we've also seen Spain, and especially in Greece, where they've adopted very strong austerity measures. Basically, people are just hit with an incredible amount of fear and despair about their well-being economically. So you directly see the suicide rates go up as a result of these economic policies.
Greece is a really interesting case in point. Its austerity was extraordinarily severe, 40%. Now, can you imagine, right across health, including mental health, you're going to have very severe consequences when those kinds of cuts come in. Also, what's interesting about Greece is historically, it has always had one of the lowest suicide rates across Europe. And yet, at one point, suicides spiked by 60% after austerity measures were introduced. Now, it's very difficult to dismiss those as pure coincidence. When you look at Greece and you look at the impact, it's very clear that something very serious was happening.
Because when we hear about suicide prevention, it's very quickly a discussion about, well, we need to screen people who have depression, because we know that there's this disease called depression, and when people have this disease, it's going to cause them to be suicidal. And so therefore, the whole way of understanding it is really put into a brain neuroscience framework. And what you're suggesting is that actually there are glaring examples of social, economic, political forces are shaping people's mental health.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, when people have a history of depression, there are issues there when it comes to suicidal behaviors and suicidal thoughts. That's without doubt. But it's extremely reductive to see it only in those terms. I mean, there's a long academic literature that looks at the impact on mental health from recessions generally, from job loss, from marital breakups as a result of financial problems. I mean, there's a long literature that shows that economic circumstances can have a detrimental effect on people's mental health. Now, some people may be more resilient than others. There are complex factors at play, but there's enough evidence out there to show how economic circumstances can impact negatively on people to tell us that when there are shocks to economic systems, that a lot of people are likely to be affected by it.
Yeah, and this reminds me of a Madness Radio interview that we did with Alicia Ali, who's a researcher at New York University, who took it the other direction. She basically took people who were depressed and then provided them with anti-poverty economic loans for small businesses, basically supported them with these micro loans. And then by improving their economic conditions, she was able to show that they had reduced rates of depression. So when we think about suicide prevention, I think we really need to look at books like your book and the research that's going on that make these more complicated connections with the health of the society as a whole, which is very much connected to the economic health and issues like austerity.
Well, I think that's a really important point. And for instance, one of the issues that has come up in Britain under austerity isn't just the impact on an individual's mental health, but the impact on the wider mental well-being within communities. So for instance, poorer communities, which are already more likely to have higher rates of suicide attempts and suicide, were the most affected by austerity policies because the cuts tended to affect poorer people. When you've got concentrations of poorer people, all of whom were probably struggling before and then are hit with these extra difficulties, well, you know, that affects the whole community. Now, we do know, for instance, that people's mental well-being is often impacted on the strength of their communities, the strength of their families. You break those social connections, you put extra pressure on those families, and that affects a lot of individuals.
Then when you're talking about the impact of these cuts, when you're talking about what austerity is and how it affects people, you mentioned the 40% decrease in public health spending in Greece. What are some other examples of how austerity actually lands in a country? What does it actually look like?
So if you look at the UK, the public expenditure cuts that were made were predominantly made to things like welfare, or social security, as I'd prefer to call it, and to local government budgets. Now, local government budgets tend to support vulnerable people in the community. The vast majority of people who are affected by austerity are already people who just need that extra bit of help. So it's very important to get that across because it doesn't blanket society. So the well-off were more or less shielded from austerity. And when that happens, you end up with a sort of separate perspective. So people who aren't affected don't understand why everyone's complaining about being affected by it, because it really divides society. And that has a massive impact as well.
So we're talking about things like public transit. We're talking about things like childcare and preschool.
Yeah,
we're talking
all
about
of those. Yeah. So for instance, there's a program in Britain called Sure Start, as a way of creating environments where parents from poorer backgrounds could bring their kids along, get a bit of extra childcare, a bit of extra support, which meant that they could go out to work and maybe work more hours if they were already working. And they were proven to be a great success. But they were one of the things that were targeted when the cuts first started coming in. Now, part of the argument for early intervention, especially with children, is that it's good for their general well-being, it's good for their education, it's good for their long-term mental health prospects. So it's a false economy to cut something like that, but yet that's what ends up being cut. Also, things like just things like support for families with disabled children. So respite services are cut, and these create enormous stresses on families and on communities. And the cuts have been so severe. And bear in mind, there's more to come. This is a cumulative situation. And if you're looking at it epidemiologically, in terms of long-term outcomes, we've only begun to see the consequences of this.
Yeah, because you're talking about the impacts of austerity on the basic fabric of a society that's going to prevent problems from coming later down the line. So this is having huge ripples. Let's talk a little bit more. You mentioned the suicide rates going up, and your book just creates such a vivid sense of the direct impact of just the shock waves of fear that go through the society when austerity policies are put into effect.
Well, when I was researching my book, I traveled all over the United Kingdom interviewing people at a grassroots level who were either already directly affected or were going to be directly affected by this thing. And one of the, I suppose, the most significant things that I walked away with from that was how frightened people were. Now, within a very short period of time after austerity policies were introduced, including reforms and cuts to welfare, the number of calls to suicide hotlines shot up. And when the callers were asked for the reasons why they were calling, a much larger proportion than before were to do with financial stresses. Now, that has huge significance because the government, of course, will say that this isn't the case. But those calls really show that that's the case. Also, prescriptions for antidepressants increased as well. Doctors, family doctors started reporting more people coming into their surgery, not just to talk about their physical illnesses or even their mental difficulties, but just because they felt like they needed to talk to someone about the stress that they were under financially. I mean, we've had situations in Britain where psychologists and other mental health professionals have taken to setting up their own anti-austerity groups because they say that in practice, every day they're seeing people coming through the doors with these issues. This is what professionals are saying. This is what people who are desperate are telling the lines that they call is causing their problems.
So the mental health professionals and the psychologists themselves are starting to say we need austerity groups and start to raise this issue because that's what they see is coming through the door of the clinics.
Oh, absolutely. And there's a new group that formed this year in Britain called Psychologists Against Austerity. They put together a briefing paper this year that looked back over the 5 years of austerity in Britain and in other countries, and they have collated the evidence for how destructive it can be. And they have been able to connect those to all kinds of policies that are directly impacting people.
And so are people turning to antidepressants partly because the funding for psychological treatments and different kinds of alternatives to pharmaceutical solutions just isn't there, and sort of that's the thing that's offered is more pills?
Yeah, I mean, it's the quickest solution. Obviously, differences between countries, differences between regions, etc. But it is often the quickest solution to someone's immediate problem. Now, in Britain, the government will say that they have increased investment in talking therapies, but the waiting times are still months and months and months. A waiting time for a talking therapy of 8 months is no use to you.
No, it's not.
And on the other hand, you have charities, community-based charities, as well as national mental health charities, who themselves have felt the strain because A, they're struggling for finances, and B, the inquiries that they're getting have increased. So their resources are stretched. You've got a reduction in what's available in terms of statutory provision of healthcare and mental health care. And at the same time, because of the wider cuts, you've got extra stress on those community organizations that often step in to fill the gap when statutory services don't. And that just leaves people in the middle with nowhere to turn. So antidepressants are often something that people will turn to in those circumstances because in Britain with the National Health Service, you can get prescriptions. And if you're poor, you get those prescriptions for free. Now, the other thing that happened in Britain, a freedom of information request by a magazine called Community Care and by the BBC looked into what exactly had happened to mental health services in the 5 years of austerity. Now, what they found was that there were 2,000 fewer acute psychiatric beds for people in crisis. There was a real-time cut in the amount of funding that went into acute services. And, of course, what does that mean? People in crisis have less available to them. What do they do? They go to A&E, accident and emergency departments.
Which ends up being more expensive, too.
Exactly. Now, the other thing, of course, that happens is that people in crisis end up in police stations because they end up getting arrested. That's expensive, too.
Yeah, this is a dynamic we see in the United States that on the front end, there's cuts to community programs, and supposedly that's for saving money, but actually ends up costing more money because people end up in more expensive situations in hospitals, emergency rooms, and in prison.
Absolutely. And this is one of the biggest problems with something like austerity. So the government says, you know, we're clearing some things off the books financially right now. Even while they're sort of technically saving in one area, those costs go somewhere else. So social care, massive cuts in Britain. Now, if you cut social care, where do those people go? They go to the health service as well when they're desperate. It's an extraordinary false economy.
Because so much of the alternative approaches are about prevention. And so it ends up just all everything. The last thing that gets cut is the emergency rooms.
And that is expensive. The evidence has been building up for a very, very long time for alternative approaches, for ways to keep people well for longer. You know, if you're enlightened about what mental health services in the broadest possible context should and could be, mm-hmm. then the money argument takes on a different dimension, if you like, because really what you want is a selection of different alternatives that might work for different people in different ways. But mm-hmm. it's a matter of changing the dialogue around mental health and mental illness and what it means to get well and be well.
Which you can't do at all if there's no resources and no budgets and no funding available for it. One of the things that you write about that's been so terrifying has been that people who are disabled, either a physical disability or they have a psychiatric diagnosis and they're not able to work, that there are mm-hmm. these audits that come in, the fitness to work audits, and it's just horrifying. Tell us about that and how austerity has impacted that.
This is got to be one of the most extraordinary, I don't know, consequences of austerity, really. And the idea behind them, of course, is to say, okay, if someone hasn't worked for a while or feels like they can't get into work because of a disability of any kind, then how do we help those people get into work? Now, that's a laudable goal. What's happened in Britain, they've gone down a very punitive route, which has made disabled people, including people with mental health difficulties, feel targeted. And they're put through these extraordinary fitness for work tests. Under this current system, people are called into these fitness for work tests. They're interviewed. The people who go through it call it a tick box. So if you're someone with serious depression, and the day that you go in for your test is actually one of your better days, maybe the only good day you've had in 6 months, mm-hmm. that's the day they will judge you on. Mm-hmm. Not what your doctor says is your long-term medical history. It's an incredibly stressful process. Some of the stories I've heard have been remarkable. We had a story where one guy went in for his test and the person interviewing him said, oh, so I see you say you're suicidal, right? And the guy says, yes, I feel suicidal. And the response was, well, why haven't you done it yet?
Wow.
Right? So now that's sometimes the level of understanding of the people conducting these interviews under the conditions that are put in place. If people don't fulfill what these assessments say in terms of taking up employment, etc., then they're penalized for it. So people will lose their benefits. Now, another aspect of that is that if you don't turn up for an appointment, then you will be sanctioned. You will have benefits removed. Now, often for people, this is the difference between eating and not eating or having heat in their house. It's why food banks in Britain have multiplied beyond all recognition. There are millions of people using food banks in Britain. That was never a phenomenon before austerity. There have been people who have been found dead in their homes, starving, and found by relatives. And the government will say you can't prove a direct correlation between the benefits changes and austerity and welfare reforms and this person's subsequent behaviour, even though the people close to them know that that's the case and watch that person deteriorate in front of them, even though at inquests, doctors have given evidence saying, I knew and I said that this person couldn't go to work. They still sanctioned them anyway.
Yeah, I know from my own experience being on disability in the United States, there was just a feeling of constant fear.
What's interesting is that the rhetoric that's deployed by government, for example, is suggesting that this is the best way to get people into work. We just need to encourage them. We just need to let them know that they can get into work. You know, that's the rhetoric. But the reality is something very different. It's very cruel. It has life and death consequences. You know, let's not mince our words. That is what happens.
One of the things that I think people question is sort of what it is that's motivating a lot of this. I mean, it seems like there's a real blame the victim kind of scapegoating of the poor that happens. Do you see that as part of austerity practices, and especially in the context of this workfare approach?
Yeah, it's fundamental to it. I mean, the austerity in the UK has been propped up by a very effective narrative, essentially pits one set of citizens against another. If policymakers manage to make it look like there are groups of people who are, as they would say, sponging off the state, then those people who don't see themselves as sponging off the state suddenly start pointing fingers. And the people that they point fingers at are those who need services. But what has been very effectively done in the UK is to make it look like, for instance, that benefit fraud is higher than it is. Because it's very clever politics. Because if you repeat something often enough, and if the newspapers and the rest of the media repeat that, it sinks in. People start to believe it. And not only do the wider public begin to believe it, but often when you're interviewing people who are vulnerable and who have been affected, they start to internalize that themselves. So people begin to think, well, maybe I am worthless. For instance, I'll give you one example of how this works in Britain and why it's managed to sort of percolate through into public opinion. If you ask the British public what the welfare budget is spent on, they will automatically say that the majority of it is spent on unemployment benefit, and a lot of that is being defrauded, when more than 50% of the welfare budget in Britain goes on pensions and pensions-related benefits. Now, one of the things that the government did when they introduced austerity, they actually increased state pension payments. So that meant that less than 50% of the overall budget had to take 100% of the cuts. But the British public think that fraud is huge. If you ask them, on average, they'll say like 40% of benefits are claimed fraudulently. It's less than 0.7%. It's proportionally insignificant. If you take away from people the things that give them hope, then what else is there? You know, this is pretty fundamental stuff. This is telling people that they are not full citizens. I'll just talk briefly about one woman's story. This was a young woman in her mid-20s, severely disabled her whole life, had gone to Cambridge University, was now an academic researcher. Now, her disability was so severe that she needed a care package. So she needed someone to help her get up in the morning, help her go to bed, you know, make sure that she was comfortable, those sorts of things. She was academically accomplished. She had a full-time job and she was researching. When the cuts started coming in and she moved to a different area for her job, she was told by her new local government that they no longer had a budget to support people like her. Hmm. So they put her through a whole load of assessments, told her that she could have help for 4 hours a day. For months and months and months, she appealed and appealed. And it was only when she threatened court action that she finally got the care package that she was entitled to. But I just want to read out a bit of what she told me. She says, "Never have I felt as subhuman and powerless as the council made me feel. There were many occasions when I wanted to stop existing and didn't know how I would get through the day. There have been just two emotions in the last months, fear and rage. I joke that the Tories, that's the Conservative Party who are in government, should just round up all of us disabled people and have a shot. It will be quicker and cheaper than what they're doing, and it would put us all out of our misery. It's a dark joke, but sometimes it doesn't feel like that." Now, that a young woman is speaking like that, to me, is pretty shocking. One of the most astonishing things to me was, while all of this was happening, the British government reduced the highest rate of tax for the highest earners.
What do you think are some of the alternatives to an austerity and neoliberalist approach to economics?
Well, this is where David Stuckler and Sanjay Bose's research is very, very enlightening. One of the interesting things that came out is that those countries that didn't introduce austerity, those countries that either kept their social protection and healthcare system spending as it was or increased it, did not have the human fallout that the countries that introduced austerity had. So somewhere like Sweden actually increased some of its spending. It saw a dip in suicides.
Mary O'Hara, we are just about out of time. Are you hopeful?
I think not to be hopeful is so self-defeating. That being said, this is an extraordinarily difficult thing to fight against. And many people in Britain and elsewhere will say that one of the reasons for that is because the narrative justifying austerity has been so successful and the media on the whole has been supportive of it. And that really does affect the ability for people to see through the obfuscation and in many cases sort of misinformation around this. So it's difficult. I really do hope that something changes soon. That doesn't seem to be on the cards in Britain right now, I have to say. But I really do hope something changes soon.
Mary O'Hara, thank you so much for joining us on Madness Radio.
Well, thank you. Well, I'm really pleased to have been able to talk to you.
You've been listening to an interview with Mary O'Hara. She's a social affairs journalist and author. She's written on mental health issues for more than a decade for The Guardian newspaper. Her new book is Austerity Bites. It's available through Chicago University Press out in paperback in the United States. And the website is austeritybitesuk.com. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
And that concludes the Monday Morning Radio Zine. Thanks for listening. And you're going to want to stay tuned. Retta is here for the Noontime Jamboree, and we're going to go to that as soon as we have the noon headlines. So you are tuned. KBOO Portland.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Monday, November 2nd, 2015. And local news. The heavy rainstorm that hit Portland on Saturday caused the Portland sewage system to overflow and spilled raw sewage into the Willamette River. The rainstorm also flooded several streets in downtown Portland and caused the MAX train service to suspend several routes. Saturday's rainfall, while not a record, did dump almost 2 inches of rain on the Portland area. In other local news, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has issued large fines to two Portland area companies for water pollution violations. The Tualatin Area Natural Food Company, Pacific Foods of Oregon, was fined more than $30,000 for discharging wastewater containing food particulates into the Hedges Creek wetlands on at least 8 different occasions. The Oregon DEQ also fined the Swan Island Shipbuilding and Repair Company, Vigor Industries, for discharging industrial pollutants into storm water drains and for failing to build a required biohazard treatment facility. The company was in the news in August when it was contracted to fix a Shell oil drilling rig that was blockaded by protesters for days while in Vigor's dry dock for repairs. The Chipotle fast food chain has temporarily closed 43 of their restaurants in Oregon and Washington due to an E. coli outbreak. This is the third food contamination outbreak to hit the Chipotle fast food chain since August. The earlier cases involved the norovirus and salmonella. In international news, while fighting continues,